Okay, I don't know. What time is it? What day is it? What's going on? Alright, well, I was less productive this week than last week. I was maybe 2/5 as productive. Never mind. Alright, I think it's only 7 o'clock. I'm gonna go beat off or something for 15 minutes and then I'll be back. Here, just stare at this fire. Alright, Jill, put on the coffee. This is going to be it's probably going to be short, but it's going to feel long.
From an undisclosed location in the Nevada desert, this is Jennifer Morenci of WTF Radio. Welcome to Open Mic Night at the Cormorant Cafe, with your master of ceremonies and master of debates, Rob. My teddy bears were stolen by a...
Ah, hello, I guess it is now 7:15-ish. What is this? This is what you get. You come early, you stare at the fire. It's not my fault. You shouldn't come early. So you deserve what you get. Alright, bring a book. I mean, come on. I want you to read up here. You can read from that book that you brought. That you could have read it instead of staring at the fire, and then you could come up here and read us the good parts. All right, anyway, as Jennifer has said in the little recycled intro that I keep using, because I think I'm allowed to do that, I'm not sure. All right, my name is Rob. This is the Cormorant Cafe. This is Open Mic Night. Presumably you know all that stuff because of all the titles and bullshit, and it's an actual podcast, not a cafe. I don't know how many episodes we have to have before it's obvious that the whole thing is fake. But anyway, since none of you want to ever read, it's just going to be me and poor Jennifer. I had someone who has like thousands, count them, thousands of followers on Twitter who maybe was going to read something, but I don't know what happened. I scared him off. That might have been good, assuming he has real followers, which I have no reason to think he doesn't, since he does his own podcast and he's a really good interviewer, it turns out. So I might get lucky. You can't see me, but my fingers are crossed. I might get lucky and have celebrity guests reading, I don't know, something. Oh, you may notice in the show notes, if I don't forget, there's a newsletter now, but it pretty much just says I did nothing and slept all week and I'm still homeless. Why are you here? But yeah, feel free to sign up to the newsletter. Maybe you'll know before we skip a week. Although if the podcast skips a week, the newsletter probably also skip a week. Anyway. Alright, so as I said before, I was less productive this week than last week. I had kind of a homeless person spa day, spa vacation spa. There's got to be a way to say it. So I had like a 4-day little break where I had motel room, which for a homeless person is like a humongous vacation. Plus, it's remarkably expensive. It used up all the money that I had squirreled away in case something happened to the car. So now if something happens to the car, I'm kind of screwed again, like I would have been. So it's like I reset my time to about the middle of November. Let's just hope it wasn't too bad. Okay, so we don't have the whole chapter 8 to read, but we do have parts 1 and 2. And it's actually kind of fun because it's you get to learn some more stuff about the narrator. And it's sort of a chapter 7 part 2, which is also kind of funny. Let me see. I think it's called The Angel and the Vampire. That's chapter 8. These middle chapters, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, however many, they're going to be like little Freak of the Week type episodes. So in a TV show type thing, you have shows where things happen to the characters or whatever that move like their character development, and then you have episodes that are kind of like Freak of the Week episodes. Yeah, so this middle section is just a bunch of that shit, the Freak of the Week stuff. So the first 5 chapters were, I actually restructured the book a little so that the first 5 chapters are Act 1, and that act now has a name and is The Arrival, or it's just called Arrival. I don't think I put The Arrival. And then this middle section is just called Random Episodes or whatever it's called. And then the last act, Act 3, is going to be, who the hell knows what it's going to be? Endgame. I don't know. Well, where do you go? I don't know. I haven't decided on what to call it. But the central mystery of the book is that, see, she can't just go and, you know, I don't know, interrogate her grandfather. She can't just go interview him or whatever, among other things. Then he would learn that she exists, let alone about time travel or any other thing. So the central thing is that she's trying to put together kind of a biography, or at least as of when he first appears on Earth, biography for him. And that's this book. And so the first part, she's pretty well pinned down the arrival stuff and his first encounter with the local, the humans. And then she's pretty well pinned down the last part. No, I'm sorry, I'm yelling. So there's these middle episodes that are, I don't know, for our purposes, it's just me making the book longer. But they're so fun to write. I don't know. You guys don't write things. You don't read things, so I don't know if you don't write things either, but some things are, they are what they are. So if I were telling you how I got here, you know, I drove across town, I went up the hill, I parked, or whatever. Okay. And then some things are just, oh, a joy, you know, like, you know, there's magic and mystery and dragons and time travel and this thing is doing that and she learned that and, you know, okay, it's fine. Never mind. I get excited about my own stuff, but I could tell you guys don't. Otherwise, the analytics would tell me I had more than 12 audience members. And I swear 8 of those are just me listening to it again because, I don't know, I really like listening to my own voice because I'm nuts. wow, this is 7 minutes of introduction. All right, well, I'm going to read some of the Key to Everything as more hype for that bonus episode. I'm going to read parts 1 and 2 of chapter, 8. We have Jennifer Morency and I talked about limericks, and she sent me something that's called Nantucket. So maybe we're going to have a limerick from her. I've got no other volunteers on the docket. So fuck you people. You damn wusses. Like I said, I keep kind of playfully harassing a minor Twitter celebrity. Cross my fingers he doesn't get pissed off and cause me to get suspended again. Alright, so welcome to the Cormorant Cafe. I again am Rob. I'll just play Jennifer's clip on the off chance that you guys came here for that. And then you can just shut it off because it's just going to be me reading lesbian love poetry and my own Macmillan the Magician chapter 8, parts 1 and 2. I hope you're ready for that. All right, I'll be back after. Here's the announcement tone. 3, 2, 1.
This is Jennifer Morenci. Welcome to another episode of WTF, the show that makes you go, WTF. The following segment contains adult language, which may not be suitable for some listeners. So I just found out about a band called Sparks from reading an AP News article. I listened to some of their songs on YouTube, and they were pretty good. They also performed with the Go-Go's from the 1980s all the way to the present day. Watching the current videos from the Go-Go's sort of reminds me of many of my neighbors, that is to say, middle-aged women in various stages of decay, or maybe I should say preservation, myself included. The last time I had professional hairstyling was right before the pandemic, so it's been a while. Right now I wear long gray hair in a ponytail, which makes me look a little older than I am. Then again, I was in elementary school when the Go-Go's first became popular, so maybe I really am getting old. Changing directions a little bit, I was thinking of nonsense rhymes the other day, and came up with this one. How many teddy bears would a teddy bear bear if a teddy bear could bear bears? So how do teddy bears reproduce anyway? New ones seem to appear at least twice a year, every January and May, for Valentine's Day and graduation respectively. The world's most famous teddy bear is Winnie the Pooh, who likes to wear a shirt, but no pants, and he did it even before the pandemic. I know that about half of you listening to this podcast are not wearing pants right now. The world's other most famous teddy bear is Paddington Bear from the UK, who wears a raincoat. So you know something weird is going on with that. For my younger listeners, there used to be a time before online porn when people had to go to an adult theater in a bad neighborhood to watch a naughty movie. Some of the men who watched those movies supposedly wore a raincoat, so that they could hide their pleasure from other members of the audience, so to speak. So Paddington Bear has probably fathered and grandfathered a lot of teddy bears. So you might wonder what happened to my stuffed animal collection, which were all gifts from my parents. A jerk former landlord stole them, because he claimed my roommate didn't pay the rent. People say to me, well, that's illegal, he can't do that. I didn't know before then that a legal aid lawyer cost $75 an hour, and I couldn't afford to pay $75 an hour to try to retrieve a stuffed animal collection worth 20 bucks. The laws don't protect poor people. Enough said. There once was a man from Nantucket. I don't remember how the rest of the limerick goes, but maybe he was a lawyer. Oh fuck it. Thank you all for being such a great audience, and best wishes for a happy teddy bear day to everyone. If you'd like to help me buy some teddy bears or cryptocurrencies, my donation link is v.gd/jennmor. My Twitter is at Jennifer Morenci with an I.
Alright, so the last time anybody who isn't me touched me, cut my hair was before the pandemic in November of some year. So I also, Jennifer, I also need to, Jesus Christ, I need to hire a barber and a whore. And they can be the same person for all I care. Just bring your clippers and some condoms. Alright, where was I? Let's see. I kind of expected more from you in the limerick department. There once was a man from Nantucket. He threw all his boots in a bucket. He whirled around the room and said, fuck it. I don't know either. I should really figure out what's going on with that shit. Okay. Yeah. My hair, what's left of it is gray, or I don't even know. Maybe it's reverting back to the clear, weird white color it was when I was a little boy. Okay, let's see, that's all there was more we're talking about. Alright, let's read something from our, The Key to Everything. This book is really small, but, okay, so, Classic Lesbian Love Poems, edited by Jerry Gomez Perlberg. I'm picking your page at random here. This is called Letter in Late July. Let's make sure it's not too long. Oh, it's just the right length. So page 49, letter in late July. It says 4M, which is actually one of my favorite Ravens and Chimes songs. It's called 4M. Never mind. Anyway, so I'm not sure how to, I guess this person's name is Honor, H-O-N-O-R, Honor Moore, M-O-O-R-E. Sounds fake. Okay, Honor Moore, letter in late July, 4M. Dearest, I have resisted these, my first lines, in more than a year, waiting for you to pass like a mood or a winter, but you persist, a landscape, it's green. That limpid pre-dusk hesitation at the swell of New England's summer, and I'm bereft. The surge of comfort has thinned to a whisper, I'm on my own, to ride the surprises, tears fast as fresh blood. Poems I wrote you 2 years ago appear in the mail, cold and published. I have no address for you, or phone. A horse, solitary, walks from a barn against a sky white with near night. A fawn picks her way across the darkening road, pulls you up out of me. You'd be surprised, wouldn't you, to hear that tonight I wept with frustration at no message from a man I keep dreaming of. I'd leave women, so eager am I not to remind my heart of you. My roses throb clear colors as night falls. A bird call cuts the warm silence like a quick axe. Rebecca looked me in the eye today. You've done it, she said. You've got yourself back. I nodded to her, post office tears still blurring, contact lenses salt fogged. Whatever I might say is as high school quaint as sobs at a mute answering box. I quiz myself as if an answer could alter my feelings as deftly as touching a key reconciles green words on a black screen. But nothing merges painlessly enough with my memory. I could cook a lamb chop or murder mosquitoes. I could go out or hang out my towels. Set phrases rise to soothe me. This too shall pass. And do as does the sound of the brook, of summer traffic on the road. White mullions edge black glass. It's night. Broken hearts are nothing new. It's past 3 months when I dream of you. Wait, when I dream you, it's a haze, colors that seem familiar. When it rains, I can hear your voice say, listen. All right. I hope you enjoyed that. So, 5 minutes. Wow. So now we're going to do my thing. Okay, you guys should know that I reserve the right to reread these two sections because Fuck you, that's why. In case I actually finish this chapter in the next week, which hopefully I will, since I've already got, what did I say, 2/5 into it? Alright, so this is chapter 8, The Angel and the Vampire. It's super title. And now keep in mind, there's a couple of more editing phases, revision phases that it goes through. If it were to be like the other book, it would have another edit of somebody who isn't me, and then it would have one more edit slash revision by me. And even then, there's going to be weird broken punctuation. So, all right, chapter 8, The Angel and the Vampire, the super chapter. And the reason I said all that stuff about editing is that these titles may change, but you should keep in mind that the narrator has a sense of humor. It's a little weird. Anyway, the super chapter title, super chapter. The title is chapter 8. Okay, no. I'm calm. What? All right, so this is chapter 8, and the title for chapter 8 is The Angel. The Angel. The chapter. This is chapter 8. The title is The Angel and the Vampire. The super title is chapter 7, part 2. It just never ends, you know? And part 1 is called West Covina again. Alright, chapter 8, The Angel and the Vampire, super title, chapter 7, part 2, it just never ends, you know, part 1, West Covina, again. Now, the narrator has one of her little notes, and it says, I had to get involved directly again. My agent was otherwise occupied, and my contemporary agent too, as he shadowed my father and uncle and their friend who'd been my lover on their mentally unhinged mission. Yes, I aided them in their twisted and disgusting objective. It don't mean I approve. To retrieve and revive Ralph's long-deceased wife, my father's idea. He's sentimental or something. That's another story, and you can read it if you want, maybe. And then that's the end of her note. I'd just returned from a visit to the Great Shrine. See, I can be sentimental too. And my goblins were frightfully freaking out in their enclosure, even upsetting a few of the younger, though usually unflappable gremlings, who were squawking and trembling and even throwing themselves at the bars of their cages as if to break free. The camp was, though, otherwise undisturbed. I rubbed the back of my neck momentarily, then saw and heard the klaxons and flashing lights. With a flick of my wrist and a sigh, these alarms were quieted, and so, after a moment or two, were my pets. One of the gremlings had severely injured its arm, and another had given itself a scalp laceration and showed signs of concussion. I endeavored to calm my charges. When all the creatures were finally calm and healed, I removed a painted monkey from under a wrist scale and touched it to the corresponding hyperviewer, which made a chime. I, to be quite honest, did not expect. I ran into my cabin and dressed for 1886 as I reviewed the overwhelming and overlapping announcements. It seems another foreign creature was spotted near the old surveillance station, which is 2, from the long ago, for me at least, days of that little blue motherfucker. I sighed. This was going to be one of those days. I decided on weapons and armor. The guy was apparently on some kind of reconnaissance. There were no pictures, of course. The amount of power it would require to transmit such things could not be easily concealed. Plain, but encoded text was all I had to go on for now. My uncle, though, had been experimenting with a lindworm, and he'd gifted me one of his more compact prototypes, about the size of a child's fist. This I affixed to the middle of my upper back with strong crisscross straps of strong goblin hide. She spells it G-O-B-L-I-N-H-Y-D-E. So it's, maybe it's artificial goblin hide. The newcomer had, I read as I munched grubs and kale salad, come from the direction of the imp's false stop or pilotless station. So I'd be headed to West Covina again. She put it in italics because, I don't know if I mentioned, but the events in this book mean that West Covina will never exist. Sorry, West Covina. It's okay, the whole area disappeared. never mind. So she's heading to italicized West Covina again. I needed time, so I sent 3 hyper packets with instruction code intended to immediately deactivate the station. I was heading further back in time, and it gets tricky. You can't cross or overlap with your own self, and the station counts because if it detected me, and it would detect me, then it may send that information in the very news briefs I'm reading right now, and kids, that's a paradox. I could not risk Butch's I could not risk Butch's machines sending us reports in our pasts about our futures. I decided I'd need a few days at least. Shook my grandfather's hourglass accordingly and activated a vortex. And then there's one of my little part break things. It's like a double spaced paragraph. So. Back to the narration. So, round about the end of spring 1886, I myself appeared in sparkling scarlet within view of Frankie's quote-unquote unmanned stop. The vortex shimmered behind me and I deactivated all transmitting radios and sat on the ground. Thinking I was early, I opened a Coke and began looking around for ideas about camping for a day or two when a shuttle nearly twice the size of Merlin's escape pod, which you'll remember is number 2, came in for a landing. She puts an exclamation mark. Hey, what the fuck? I bleated. I made myself invisible and drank my soda and watched in fascination. I checked and double-checked my chronograph. Yep, 1886. Atmospheric radiation tests confirmed. They're just going to blithely land and... A lone man wearing beautiful tech armor from head to toe emerged from the craft. It, the armor, was of a kind of dusky orange with matte black trim. I loved him. It was beautiful. He was taller than the imp creature and humanoid, though I couldn't tell as yet if it was a primate or something else. He retrieved a large shroud or tarpaulin from his shuttle, which he shook and then used carefully, almost patiently, to cover the vehicle. The effect was immediate. The shroud and vehicle vanished. With notions of approaching for a closer look, I stood. But if this entity has cloaking abilities, he likely also has anti-stealth tech. From a belt upon his hips, he unclipped a metallic-looking device with some of the same matte black versus dusky orange ornamentation, which he held up in front of his eyes as though looking through it. He was still. He swept his arms, rotating the machine and then his whole body too, and as I knew he would, he headed in the direction of the imp's hidden structure and underground lair. Although the chance it was a coincidence and he was heading for the trees and possibility of water was not, of course, ruled out, but too, my bird hide and surveillance equipment. I shouted him as quietly as possible as he ventured forth. He unfastened and removed orange and black gloves, then helmet. He looked like a Mark I human being. She puts an exclamation mark. And an excellent specimen he was, too. He had an uncontrollable head of dishwater blonde hair, strong cheekbones above an adequate chin, beautiful, biteable lips, deep, soulful eyes. I licked my lips, wishing the motion would allow me to smell him, but lo, I was too far away for now. What would be wrong with the direct approach? I could just become visible, catch up with him, and, hey, George. My mind was filled with this and other more prosaic fantasies as I watched and I followed. The transmitting muted, as I've said. I was still able to receive, and as we rapidly approached the scene of so much drama and waiting and dismay, Surveillance Station 2's work came flooding through. The alien, but not an alien, would no doubt discover my bird hide. Rather than panic, which is the appropriate response to this impending emergency scenario, I had quick, breathless fantasies of being inside and nude, but restless when this happened. I missed Ralph, perhaps? After Merlin bolted, throwing off his backpack and baiting the imp to his demise, I had not been back. Neither of us had. And in the instance, it was good. We detected this human. However, strictly speaking, it violated protocol, and, as we'll soon see, this lapse in judgment left us open to detection. At any rate, I was not prepared for what we found. Merlin had most thoroughly excavated the imp's lair. All that remained was a huge crater. It was a giant hole which met us, though the human did find some of the... Okay, well, some rude asshole cut me off with a fucking phone call, and then they didn't even talk to me when I answered it. Fuck. What is wrong with people? You're gonna call me? At least talk to me. Why? What? Okay. Where were we? Okay, after Merlin bolted, his rabbits, okay, After Merlin bolted, throwing off his backpack and baiting the imp to his demise, I had not been back, neither of us had, and in the instance, it was good, because we detected this human. However, strictly speaking, it violated protocol, and, as we'll soon see, this lapse in judgment left us open to detection. At any rate, I was not prepared for what we found. Merlin had most thoroughly excavated the imp's lair. All that remained was a crater. It was a giant hole which met us, though the human did find some of the imp's long sticks, robbed of their hatchet/spear ends, and, luck for him, but not for me, one of Merlin's sonar cylinders. Fuck, Grandpa, what the hell? If I didn't know my surveillance station number 2 was there, perhaps I wouldn't think this, but the human newcomer appeared to be intentionally ignoring the bird hide. And in one of her notes it says, I, of course, strove to avoid being detected by my own equipment while observing all of the above. End her note. The man from the shuttle held his shiny machine up again. He swept the area and managed to find one of the blue steel ladder rungs. And then she closes this part out with another one of her notes. It says, is Merlin intentionally leaving shit behind now? Should I throw my cherry Coke can into the giant pit and shrug and walk away? And that ends part one. And I was so close to the end when that stupid phone call came. Grr. Thank you. All right. So much for part one and being interrupted when I'm fucking almost done reading. All right, let's read whatever the hell this is that I just accidentally opened to. This book is not really that big, but... Alright, so this is from someone named Cheryl Clarke, who's spelled the same as Arthur C. Clarke. C-L-A-R-K-E. It says, of Althea and Flaxie, F-L-A-X-I-E. In 1943... Oh, I'm sorry, this is another lesbian love poem from The Key to Everything. As part of our preview for the bonus episode... which is called The Key to Everything, and it's all about classic love poems, and I'm trying to get other people to read it. Read from this book. You would think that people would just jump at the chance, I guess. I just am really bad at negotiating simple things. All right, so Cheryl Clarke of Althea and Flaxie. In 1943, Althea was a welder, very dark, very butch, and very proud, loved to cook, sew, and drive a car, and did not care who knew she kept company with a woman, who met her every day. The way it's formatted, you guys, fuck's sake. And did not care who knew she kept company with a woman who met her every day after work in a tight dress and high heels, light-skinned and high-cheekboned, who loved to shoot, fish, play poker, and did not give a damn who knew her quote-unquote man was a woman. Althea was gay and strong in 1945, so it's been 2 years. Oh. Althea was gay and strong in 1945 and could sing a good song. From underneath her welder's mask and did not care who heard her sing her song to a woman. Flaxie was careful and faithful, mindful of her southern upbringing, watchful of her tutored grace, long as they treated her like a lady. She did not give a damn who called her a bull dagger. I don't know what that is. Okay, I guess it's been 5 years now. In 1950, Althea wore suits and ties. Flaxie's favorite colors were pink and blue. People openly challenged their flamboyance, but neither cared a fig who thought them, and she puts these things in quotes, queer or funny. When the girls bragged over break of their sundry loves, Flaxie blithely told them her old Lady Althea took her dancing every weekend and did not give a damn who knew she clung to a woman. When the boys on her shift complained of their wives, Althea boasted of how smart her stuff Flaxie was and did not care who knew she loved the mind of a woman. This poem just went weird. In 1955, when Flaxie got pregnant and Althea lost her job, Flaxie got herself on relief and did not care how many caseworkers threatened midnight raids. Althea was set up and went to jail. Jeez, Althea, what the hell? For writing numbers in 1958. Wow, the time is really flying. I'm going to have to look up what writing numbers is. To assume it's something that we frown upon. Althea was set up and went to jail for writing numbers in 1958. Flaxie visited her every week with gifts and hungered openly for her through the bars and did not give a damn who knew she waited for a woman. When her mother died in 1965 in New Orleans, Flaxie demanded that Althea walk beside her in the funeral procession. She did not care how many aunts and uncles knew she slept with a woman. I'm sad. When she died in 1970, Flaxie fought Althea's proper family not to have her laid out in lace and dressed the body herself, and did not care who knew she'd made her way with a woman. I guess it's over. Wow, okay. I don't expect them to be sad. All right. Okay, so that's another key to everything. And now, back to Macmillan the Magician, Chapter 8. We're going to read Part 2. And Part 2 is called Unmasked in the Wild West. And... Alright, so Chapter 8 of Macmillan the Magician, Part 2, Unmasked in the Wild West. And this is the last part that's actually written, and hopefully I will write more, probably 3 more parts. Alright, the newcomer spent several hours combing over what I'd have taken for a meteor impact or crash site. And then, though I was invisible and hidden in the trees and far behind him, to my fright and utter amazement, turned on his heel and walked right toward me. I'd been crouching, but here now I stood up, but otherwise chanced to remain hidden and invisible. When he had nearly met me, less a couple meters, he greeted me in American English. "Hi, Andromedan lady. I'm Blake." Transferring his gizmo from right to left, he put out his hand in the handshake gesture. Blake waited patiently. After a minute or two of this impasse, he said, "Look, I waited until your surveillance equipment powered down and went silent. Now, if you'd be so kind, I have questions." His eyes weren't focused on me, so he couldn't, after all, actually see me. I made myself visible and stepped into view. "Tisman," I said, and took his bare hand in my gloved one. "You're blue," Blake observed. "My grandfather..." "It's a long story," I said, suddenly flustered. "How can I help you?" He hesitated. "Wasn't aware your people were so tall." She's talking. "My father preferred tall women," and then she puts a little note. "What is wrong with me?" And ending her note. Blake, apparently realizing something of some urgency, pulled an orange and black handkerchief from a hip pocket, which he quickly began wrapping around the front of his face below his eyes. He tied this mask behind his head and adjusted it under his chin, but it was too late. "You smell so..." he started and fell into my lustful arms. The mask, which came off again easily, had the faint aroma of iguana urine. I placed it into one of my own hip pockets for later examination. I removed his armor as he removed mine. We removed each other's clothing in a whirlwind and a frenzy. I'd assumed he saw me for what I am, but in truth, I'd no idea what he saw when he looked at me. As he spoke of the Argyria, remember the silver nitrate poison from the first chapter, from a million billion years ago in the second chapter? The thing where Macmillan poisons the air trying to kill the werewolf with the silver nitrate. It makes you turn blue. Anyway, he mentioned that and my height after all. But now, as we looked and bit each other in a sea of our clothing and armor, he was giving my chest a good deal of attention, which would have made more sense were I a human woman. I admit I was slightly disappointed, but I allowed him for the moment to have his delusions. I ran spiked and clawed and scaled fingers through his mess of thick head hair and allowed myself to fall into our lovemaking. He kissed and nibbled ferociously, even for a young human male, and when the time came, and it took little enough time indeed, I was rather pleased with things. And then I allowed Blake his pleasures, and this is all italics. He was insatiable. Now she has one of her little notes. But then I was in physical contact with him, and that, as you know, of course, kept up his youthful vim and vigor, and end her note. And italics. Eventually, sensing immense areas of bruising up and down my inner thighs, I was forced to gas him so I could sleep. And that ends part two. And I'm going to read the first part of part three that's tentatively called Disclosures, even though it's only a couple paragraphs. And I'll probably reread it if we continue this nonsense in a future podcast. So three, Disclosures. I awoke and Blake was still sprawled atop me, nude and beautiful as always. I carefully extracted myself and attempted to clean up some of the discarded scales and molted skin. There was, however, little I could do about all my gelatinous secretions, which covered him and the ground. Thankfully, though, our clothes and armors were spared this further indignity. The egg sac was hardening in my abdomen, and I nearly started retching with the pain. I satisfied myself of his slumber by slapping his face a few times and went into the shadows and cover of the nearby trees. I urinated, which lowered some of the pressure, and the egg sac dislodged. This was more painful than I remembered, but perhaps I always think that. Swiftly, I dug a shallow hole where the shadows seemed most permanent and was reaching for the silver nitrate when I realized the canister was no longer strapped on my ankle. Everything's an ordeal, I mumbled to myself, as I'd often heard from a similarly flustered butch. I carefully nestled my egg sac in the loamy soil, returned to my sleeping lover, and located the canister easily. I brought it and a Nutri-Pack back and sprayed the eggs thoroughly. I regurgitated something hopefully nutritious, dropped the Nutri-Pack in the hole, and covered everything with loose soil. It is quite unlikely the eggs were fertilized by a human outside of a laboratory, but most of the above is instinct anyway. Returning to Blake's sleeping body, I separated our belongings, dressing myself in clothes and gear and carefully examining his. I ate one of my packed meals and thought and dreamed. Eventually, he began making sounds, and I returned to him and positioned myself to give him a happy awakening, which he enjoyed. Though I'd looked through his stuff, I still knew little more than his name, probable species, and the chemical makeup of his semen. Alright, let me read another one of these. Where the fuck did it go? It's a little tiny book, by the way. Things get lost. Little tiny books get lost. Alright, so St. Martin's Press. The Key to Everything, Classic Lesbian Love Poems, edited by Jerry Gomez Perlberg. Apparently cost $10 at one time. The Key to Everything. This is from 1995, so no wonder they're so modern. There's acknowledgments. Anyway, I wanted to read the thing on the back flap of the page, the cover. Jerry Gomez Perlberg is an award-winning poet whose work has appeared in many anthologies and journals, including Women on Women, which it says NAL, 1993, and Calyx, I don't know what that is, C-A-L-Y-X. It says she lives in New York City. It says this is a Stonewall Inn book. Jacket designed by Charles Rue Woods. Photograph 1994 by Susan Ruddick Bloom / Swanstock. All right, now we're going to pick the book. Open at random. What do we see? Here we go. Page 56. Linda L. Nelson. It's called Throughway. There is no order here. I scrub floors and wipe. I scrub floors and wipe fur from the white metal range, thinking I will leave this place and then not. I reach for your face, waist. How we love people in pieces. Here is your gray-green tattoo inscribing the pale silk above your breast. Here your full-throated rendition of country western melodramas as we rattle down the throughway. Orchards race up hillsides to toss globes at the sun. My feet guide yours among dancing worlds. Always knowing where to step. Always knowing where to step next, yet tearing my flesh as I cross river and ridge in opposite directions. We spin a thick glass, and its force makes us hot and huge. We leave the smell of hair burning behind us. And that's all for that one. And the next one is page 58. This is Judy Grahn, G-R-A-H-N. Doesn't seem to have a title. And I'll just read it. Love Road, 1,500 miles on a Greyhound bus and climbed in my window one night to surprise both of us. The pleasure of that sleepy shock has lasted a decade now or more because she is always still doing it and I am always still pleased. I do indeed like aggressive women who come half a continent just for me. I am not saying that patience is virtuous. Love, like anybody else, comes to those who wait actively and leave their windows open. Alright. Well, since nobody came to read except Jennifer, who is like my damn savior angel in these trying times. Anyway, I guess I can just thank you guys for subscribing, listening, leaving reviews, telling your friends. I have to assume there's like either nobody or nobody is doing the above, because the analytics pretty much say I'm pretty much listening to my own self and that's it. But I'm sure there's at least one person, and hey, Dave. Okay. I don't know anyone named Dave. It's supposed to be a joke. One day though, somebody named Dave will be listening to this and he'll be like, he's clearly talking about another Dave. Anyway, that's it. Jill is finishing up the cleaning the counter there, and we're going to turn the lights off. The mic is closed. Thanks again for coming to the Cormorant Cafe, and I'll see you next Wednesday at 7:15. Ciao. Don't forget to tip your barista. She's still here. And Morency, you can tip her too. Hell, for that matter, you can tip me. Oh, sign up for the newsletter. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. And buy the other book. You'll like it. And if you don't, well, I'll keep your $20 anyway. Ciao, for real this time.
I am reality's whore!
This place is dangerous.